Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy's all fired up today.
I was doing my Steve Martin impersonation from the 1980s. You know, just trying to get Tony fired up and ready to go.
Yeah, because I'm...
And in a good mood. Make him laugh.
Oh, my God. Really? Clearly, this is live today. We, as happens sometimes, we have a disagreement. And no. So the program is about that disagreement.
Uh-huh.
On principle, an aesthetic principle,
mm-hmm.
between French cooking and Italian cooking as far as how products are treated,
mm-hmm.
and the aesthetic of each of the two cuisines. So we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear what you think was maybe the greatest thing you ever ate that was a French dish, or the greatest thing you ever ate that was an Italian dish. But we're going to try to talk it out here before we... becomes a fist fight or something
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can reach us at 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org.
Yeah, because I don't think a whole lot of people are out grilling right now.
That's just a little spritz out
it's
there.
It's a little rainy. Yeah. I mean, when did your love for Italian food start, Tony?
And it's not that I don't love French food, because
you know
very well that
I
do.
And you know I love Italian food, so.
But there is a... There's an honesty. There is something I find very clean about the Italian aesthetic that's very appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
When an awful lot of the cooking is driven from a long history of being relatively impoverished and gratitude for the small things that you have,
mm-hmm.
you know, and using great care with those small things, I think of it as being more of a grassroots cooking. You know, it's the whole population, you know, that it's the plebeians, it's not the patricians driving the cooking, if that makes sense.
Sure.
When I think of French food, I think of pretty lavish stuff. I think of, it's to me, that's driven top down through the culture. You know what I mean?
And now I'm going to disagree with you. Now you've said something I disagree with.
Well,
because I think
when you think of the cooking, though, you know.
Well, you know, you can look at French food in a couple of
ways. Escoffier was not cooking for
a bunch
of peasants in a tavern.
That's my point. You can look at it a couple of different ways, because, of course, there were plenty of people. You know, there's a foundation of peasant cooking, or whatever you want to call it, in French food, just as there is in Southern food, just as there is in any culture. But I think we also, you know, and that's, we think of the foundation, and especially if you're a professional cook, you think of the foundation of most of our cooking principles as classic French cooking. And, you know, when you go to culinary school, it used to be, it's not that way anymore, because we've had, since I went to culinary school in the 80s, there's, you know, obviously, you know, molecular cooking became a very, very big thing, and also sort of became a foundation of cooking principles as well. But when you reach back to when I went to school, everything was based on Escoffier's principles.
And what is the first thing that you learn? What are the five
mother sauces? The mother sauces.
And
we think of sauce cooking as being very refined, and it is refined cooking, and that's true. But of course, as we've already said, you know, of course there's, you know, lots of dishes that are in French cooking that are based on, you know, inferior cuts of meat, or, you know, fish and things that would have been very inexpensive to cook with because you would have just gone out and caught them.
You think of something being covered instead of, I guess, Italian food for me is celebration of an ingredient. You know, it's, hey, you know, Roberto, I have a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do with it? You know, how are we going to, What are we going to do that's going to make it seem the most like the tomato that it is? Or what is going to make these porcini mushrooms seem the most flavorful and show up exactly what they are?
And you've definitely sparked something in my mind by saying that, too, because, you know, when you say covered, you know, I know that the main reason French food had such heavy sauces, or sauces that might have had a lot of spices or something with a lot of flavor, was because of lack of refrigeration. Because there wasn't any. And, you know, you were eating food that was not rancid, of course, but it wasn't as nice as it could have been.
It was sometimes on the way out.
Right. And so I think that really, truly was why, you know, food was handled the way that it was, you know, with with sauces and things in French cooking. And then you have nouvelle cuisine happen in, you know, the 50s, 60s, and you see a lightening of sauces and a lightening of presentations and a view towards healthier cooking. And
I would say nouvelle cuisine gets a bad rap at times. People joked about when the principles were
right.
Unsuccessfully and really not generously applied.
Well, that's also because as all things that start as an idea that people aren't necessarily completely cognizant of at the time, you know, a group of people are sort of starting to come up with a trend. They don't know they're coming up with something that is a change, and then it becomes a trend, and then a trend always seems to end up in the dumpster. You know, I mean, it oftentimes things just get abused.
You say that
to the
very
end.
Seeing those guys burn the disco records at Shea Stadium in 1979, that's when I think of the end of a trend.
Okay.
Anyway, that's two quick things. So we are live. You can join in the conversation that we're going to try to keep civil here. The 410-662-8780. And you can stump for a particular dish or refute something that we're saying. You're welcome to straighten us out if you need to.
Absolutely.
ForemanWolf@WYPR.org is the email address that you can get things to us. And we're going to back up 1 second. The mother sauces. So we're talking about French food. Just for folks, what are the five mother sauces?
So your foundation sauces are bechamel, which is, you know, milk with a roux, and I won't go into all the ingredients and everything, but you have bechamel, hollandaise, brown sauce, which is called espagnole, tomato, and velouté. So you have the sauces that are foundation sauces from which all other sauces come. And there's also, not everybody agrees on what the five mother sauces are, but, you know, I think that the idea of a cream or a milk-based sauce, a tomato-based sauce, a stock-based sauce, and then you have hollandaise, which is an egg-based sauce, are the four most important ones, because you also think of mayonnaise in there. And, when you define a cuisine like Escoffier did, almost like writing a Bible, the Bible of cooking. Very unusual. That's an unusual approach for someone to have done that.
I don't think
it was done for Italian cooking. So, I mean, I think that's also one of the things that sort of separates the two, because it's been so well defined.
Well, you know that I would say that geography has a lot to do with that. In the same way that Italy speaks eight languages every day.
Amazing.
France does not, you know, that there's a homogeneity to a lot of the culture, regardless of some of the regional product differences.
Right.
Because of the easy geographic connection between regions, and compared to Italy, which is sprawling, narrow,
a mountain range going down the middle of the country,
difficult to transport. And always outward looking, because all but one province is on the sea. All but two provinces on the sea.
Yeah, which is
you
nice.
Know? I mean, so the each one of those, they have very individual personalities. In Friuli versus Umbria versus the Marche or Calabria or Sicily. I mean,
or Alto Adige.
And they have completely, where German is the first language.
Yeah, just, wow, so amazing.
So, I mean, that you have in each of those areas, there are books that we don't see in the States. I mean, you know, I have some. I have a Neapolitan book that's amazing, that's specific not just to Campania, but to the city. And the food history of the city, and that is the Bible, and frankly, it's as detailed as Escoffier, but it's incredibly small
region
and super myopic.
It's regional rather than
Escoffier, instead of like these are the uniting principles under which we cook.
Right.
This is what we do, and I'm documenting what we do in this one small place.
Well, frankly, it makes Italian food a very fascinating cuisine because of all the tremendous different cultural influences on the cooking and the history of the country and the geographic aspects.
I mean, I would also say that, I mean, when I say Italian principles, it's very hard for me to say Italian, because the biggest commonality with Italian cooking is approach, because the products are incredibly diverse, and you know, you have sort of gross regions of where you see polenta, and regions where you see rice, and then regions where you see pasta with egg and pasta without egg down south. But other than those starches kind of uniting a couple of different regions, there's not a whole lot of unifying principle, because there are areas that use a lot of olive oil. There's areas that use dairy, areas mm-hmm. that use none, mm-hmm. Areas where the only cheese is dried cheese, you know, preserved calories in poor places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's...
Well, you could also say the same thing about France. Provence is a very different region than Normandy.
Except that getting a ghost cheese from Provence to Normandy
is a little easier.
It's a lot easier.
Yes.
than getting chilies from Calabria to Piemonte.
Yeah, but not
Piemonte.
200 years ago. That's the other thing. You know, when you talk about a cooking that is so old, unlike ours, unless you go to Native American cooking, but if you go to the cooking of the last 250, 300 years, you know, it doesn't have the history that these other cultures do. And, you know, those things are so pristine because of, you know, the, even though modern world has occurred in Italy and France, there's so much rich, deep history in their cooking that it holds fast no matter what. And I think that is something that is very special and extraordinary about, you know, countries that are so much older than ours, because we don't have that with ours. We tend to, you know, lose our history a little bit quicker here.
Well,
too.
We're a melting pot also. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the we expect things to fuse and become new and adapt and change with every generation, and that's the nature of the country, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the changes are all sort of in place and slowly and multi-generational in a lot of other places. And as has become a modern world, it may change quickly on the surface, but there's still these deep connections. It's very interesting.
It is. You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why I like Southern cooking so much, because it is one of our oldest, you know, food cultures, and it is steeped in Western European cooking. And you know, I think that it is pretty rich. It is pretty rich for us, the Southern cooking, and with the West African influences, and gosh, you know, it's...
But it is inherently a melting pot.
Oh, absolutely.
Cooking, it is, absolutely. You know, maybe the most American food because of that.
Yeah.
So, and you can reach us if you like, if you want to chime in about a very favorite French dish, or a very favorite Italian dish. Happy to mm-hmm. entertain your thoughts on the topic. But, yeah, I guess we kind of got serious on you this afternoon.
It's interesting.
So, and you can get us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. That's an email from a listener looking for restaurant recommendations in Florence. And... hello, Linda, going out for her birthday in Florence.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah, and beautiful town. I've not had great meals in Florence, frankly, because I've not been in Florence that much. I largely get to wine country and to smaller places. So, I mean, if their favorite places of mine in and around Siena and close by, and San Gimignano, which is a relatively short drive, but all through the Chianti Classico zone, all through the Chianti zone, that road between the wine road between Siena and Florence,
mm-hmm.
there's all kinds of excellent trattoria and little villages there.
Yeah, I was waiting to hear what you were going to say, because I do feel like when you travel, you're always in the country, pretty much.
I mean, that there is a famous 3-star that's there that has a...
In Florence?
Yeah, it has a crazy wine cellar, and I've eaten there, and I was underwhelmed, so I
don't have
a hard time with that one.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, I haven't been to Florence since the first time I went to Europe when I was a kid, so I can't help with that.
Yeah. I mean, super beautiful.
Mm. Amazing.
So, you tell me, what is the best French dish you've ever had?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think.
Or what is that one archetypal dish that you're like, yes, this is my heart?
You know, I think, it always comes back to truffles for me because it was something that I never experienced in my entire life. And then, you know, I was, you know, 35 years old or something and went to France. And, you know, we had that experience where the man walked into the room where the waiter walked into the room where we were eating and he had a tray full of truffles and he walked behind me and I smelled them and I'm like, what's that? And it was the first time I ever ate truffles and you had that dish three times or something. It was so simple. It was fingerling potatoes with sliced truffle and excellent extra virgin olive oil from the region, which was Provence and probably fleur de sel. And I mean, it was just absolutely brilliant. And to get to experience something like that, that I had never, ever imagined in this world that I would eat something that tasted like a truffle. I mean, that was a turning point for me as a person and as a someone that eats and as a chef as well. And I mean, I'll never forget that, but it's very hard for me to say one dish. You know, I think one of the greatest things about eating French food or European cooking is their seafood. And we ate at a restaurant called L'Astor in Paris that a very famous chef had closed his restaurant. And he, you know, was sort of giving his guys a chance.
Oh, yeah, the sole with the baby artichokes and lemon baby calamari.
Yeah, it was just, and to have baby calamari, that was something I'd never had in my life. And I think we also had
it was one of the most Italian French dishes I've ever had.
Well, there you go.
when we come back, we'll take your calls. I know we have one holding. Please hang on and we'll get to you. You're listening to Formula Wolf on Food & Wine on WIPR, and we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us formanwolf@wipr.org. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And we have some folks sending us a bunch of stuff right now, which is cool.
It is cool.
And remind me to get... I went to market this morning and talked to a bunch of farmers. Remind me to come back to that at some point. This year is looking like a nicer year right now.
Good.
For sure.
Exciting. Yes.
Let's go to caller Carol.
Hi, Carol. How
Carol,
are you today?
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to thank both of you because even though you say you're fighting on the air, it's the most civil fighting that is going on right now. And I just thank you for being able to both be passionate and have opposite or differing opinions and continue to talk to each other. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Carol. That's very, very kind. It's, I mean, as long as Cindy knows that she is wrong and I'm right, then I'm going to remain very civil.
Carol, help.
Think of all the discussions going on where everyone always thinks they're right, but they stop the discussion or they call each other names. I mean, it's fun to listen to you guys.
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
That's my comment. And then my question is just, is there a cuisine in South America? I'm not talking about Mexico or, you know, Central America, but actually South America, where there is a technique or a food product or a dish that you guys have enjoyed or seen or feel is important?
Definitely.
Well, thanks.
That's a great question.
I don't know that either one of us are huge experts on broadly South American food. I mean, we spent a lot of time.
But we both have a great interest in it.
Yeah, I mean, spent a lot of time studying Argentine food. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. Like anywhere in the New World, the immigration pattern has had a lot to do with what the end product. You know, it's immigration, economics, and the natural products available. are what create the cuisine of the place. So, I mean, I think a little bit like different regions in the U.S. Have very different cooking for very strong reasons. But I don't know that there's anything that necessarily unites South American food more than the colonial powers that sort of, you know, set the tone in different places, whether it was French or Portuguese or Spanish. And it's about the products. Because, and it's funny, in every different part of South America, immigration has been different. So, I mean, Argentina is interesting in that there's a huge amount of Italians had moved into what was Spanish colonial originally situation. So,
I think Carol was asking, you know, also about what some of the food is that's had an impact on us. And I mean, yeah. I worked with an Argentine chef when I first started cooking, and his name was Marcelo Vasquez, and I cherished every moment I got to work with him, and learned how to make empanadas with him, and just really sort of got to understand the grilling techniques and how important the process of grilling was to him, and what he grew up with. His family had a home in Buenos Aires and in Mendoza. They had a ranch in Mendoza. So there were times when Marcelo would do parties for the employees that I will never forget. We were, as I said, in the Charleston area. We would go out to one of the barrier islands, and it was sort of like, you know, he would have this gigantic grill, this huge piece of metal grill. He would build the fire very, very early in the morning before, you know, any of us were up, certainly, and would get everything going. And he would have whole chickens and, you know, a whole prime rib on there and peppers. And, you know, I had never seen any, and whole links of sausages. I had seen anybody
grill. A big proper asado.
Exactly. But I had never seen that in my life. I was in my early, well, I was actually, I think, 20 then. And, you know, to see this, that was just, you know, that was very impactful for me. And what a gift it was, considering the fact that I was here and experiencing something that was truly Argentine through an Argentine man. And he was a great cook, Marcelo, and a fascinating person, and just very thankful for that. So there's always been a little bit of an Argentine influence on my cooking because of my experiences with him. And, you know, when the first time he made chimichurri, which, you know, was long before anybody had it on their menu anywhere in this country, as far as I can remember, I will just not forget that because it was so delicious. And again, it was a totally different approach to, for me, I did not grow up eating something like chimichurri with beef. And my dad was in the beef business. So for me, Argentina is particularly important because of my chef that I worked for.
But I mean, even in our city, you can go and find real food from Peru, Venezuela, everywhere in Central America. I mean, Brazilian food. There's plenty of interesting things to run across. But I mean, a lot like here, there's always a melting pot character to what that food is.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks,
Carol.
Thank you for calling.
Keep fighting.
Oh, we will. We will. I'm about to make an important point to prove the wrong.
How to do it? Just know.
You're very kind.
Okay. Bye bye.
Have a good day.
So here's to my point. Will is really hungry. Will, the lovely gentleman who takes care of calls and emails for us.
Uh-huh.
What do you think he's eating? Is he eating beef bourguignon?
No.
Is he having quiche?
I don't know. I'm not following.
Take a look in the control room.
Uh-oh. I don't know
Yes,
what that is
pizza.
Oh, Tony.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Game, set, match.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right. Thanks for the help, Will.
So the we do have an email from a listener about the best thing that they ever had.
Oh, good.
They were in Italy in 2009.
Yes.
Not France. And the best dish the person had was risotto. It's from Nia. It was a seafood risotto and was amazing. And immediately I want to ask, where in Italy were you?
That you said her because name was Mia?
Nia.
Oh, Nia. Okay.
But yeah, Nia, if you want to write us back, tell us where you are and what was the seafood that was in the risotto.
Yeah, I want to know. Risotto is one of my favorite things ever. I love risotto. It's fun to make.
Now, what would an Italian never put in a seafood risotto?
Cheese.
Correct.
Never put cheese in risotto for seafood.
Tip for all people that if you have a snooty Italian food person, like I've been accused
like
of being.
Like you?
No, I just like things correct. That's all. That, don't be the person that has cheese on their seafood pasta.
Yeah, don't do that. Well, it's doesn't taste good, quite frankly. There's a reason.
No, I don't think
it doesn't work.
I mean, seafood is about being very fresh.
Cheese
flavor.
Doesn't always work with all the other things you put in risotto, too. But yeah, that is sort of the rule. You know, the process of making risotto to me is such a labor of love. You know, you should constantly stir the dish. You're adding small amounts of liquid at a time. There's so many different risotto. I mean, I've been making risotto for many, many years.
There's so much care in the food.
Oh,
that's the thing. It's almost therapeutic, right?
Mm-hmm. Risotto is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is?
So you're trying to say French food isn't therapeutic?
What is the French dish? What is the French dish that makes you feel, you know,
happiness
psychologically
like
so strongly?
When I make potato gratin, I feel almost the same way that I do when
is it,
I make risotto.
Is it because you want to eat it, or is it because
both
you like peeling the potatoes?
Both of them. Both. I can't wait to eat it, and it is a labor of love because it takes a long time to make a really good potato gratin and slice your potatoes correctly. And yep. And then the other labor of love is reduction sauce. Because you have to roast the bones and make a really good stock, and then you have to, the stock takes many hours, and then you have to reduce it down, and then you have to finish the sauce, and, you know, that's another labor of love as far as I'm concerned with French food. And it's one of my favorite things to make. People often ask me, what do you like to work with? And it's very hard for me to answer, but sauce making is definitely, you know, really one of my favorite things ever.
Are you done?
Yes.
Sauce making.
Mm-hmm.
You know I'm half joking about that.
Uh-huh.
Because there are all those famous Italian sauces. Like what?
Like what?
Exactly.
Like what?
An email from Roger in Baltimore. Uh-huh. The difference between the two regions is an interesting conversation, but I want to know how the two can come together. Would you ever match an Italian wine with a French dish or vice versa?
Absolutely.
Is there an ideal match to bring these two together? And there's a certain amount of, I mean, when you're pairing things up, there's a certain amount of, when it grows together, it goes together. And that kind of makes sense because the same palate and you know, that developed the dish is the palate that's developed the wine that's of that place. I mean, there's
winemakers think about the food when they're making the wine. That was one of the greatest moments for me as a chef when we went to France and met with French winemakers. And I did say French winemakers, where, you know, we're in the cellar and I never knew that, you know, that's just the great love of cooking in France is, you know, the winemakers talking not about necessarily the technology or whatever, because they probably have been making this wine for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, but
and
also,
technology mostly interrupts the quality.
He or she are talking about, you know, this wine would be, you know, going with this particular dish that my wife makes or my husband makes or my, you know, we have in this region. And, you know, that is, so it does go hand in hand, but that does not to say that a Suave isn't good with, you know, something from, you know, Italian grape is always going to be good with anything as with wine, right, Tony? It's always the dish, you know?
It's the contents of the dish. What's a very French asparagus dish?
With vinaigrette, you know.
Yeah, with a vinaigrette.
Or hollandaise, with tarragon, something like that.
So, Suave, I know no match for asparagus. Attention, listeners, this is asparagus season.
Mm-hmm.
I know no better match for asparagus specifically than Suave. The grape is Garganega. The principal grape is Garganega. Sometimes there's a little Trebbiano in there.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I was thinking.
Suave Classico is, you know, that reaches across the border with no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that Châteauneuf du Pape in particular in France reaches across the border to some of the regional dishes, especially from Sardinia, and to some of the meat dishes in Tuscany, especially some of the traditional pork dishes. I don't know that. It's funny when I think about pasta, I always want a little more acidity, and that usually means the stronger, a little bit denser acidity you find in an awful lot of Italian reds.
Okay.
So that I struggle with that a little bit, and sometimes I was thinking about is there a beef dish in France that I would want to have Brunello de Montalcino with? And it the thing that makes it a little hard is that there is a little bit rougher edge to the tannins that matches up differently with some of the sauces that you're talking about. And so that there are definitely places for it. I mean, to answer the question for Roger, there are places where you can do it, but it's not always the best match, if that makes sense.
Well, and oftentimes, doesn't champagne kind of go with so many things? Like, it seems like that's almost friendlier with Italian food than
that's one of the funniest things.
Probably anything else, right?
In Italy and great restaurants and any kind of what the Italians would call important restaurants, you find, besides an awful lot of Italian wine, you will find wine from Champagne because it is pretty darn unique in what it can do with food. Good. And it's an interesting, and they see the
a
same thing
marriage.
In Spain. It's a pretty interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, if you're going
but
to...
That's a harder question than I actually... I don't think about it all the time. Well, it's also part of it.
But you're constantly pairing wines with menus, menu items. So it's interesting.
See,
that.
And you do food. I mean, when I'm pairing things with things that you do, I know where you're coming from, and I know what the dish is going to be like. But it's not exactly a traditional dish of place X.
Right.
It's your personal cooking, and it makes it very easy for me to use anything on the whole world palette of wine. You can make a ceviche with rockfish from the bay, and maybe what I want for that is a Grunewaldliner from Austria that has a little bit of bottle age on it, depending upon how you dress it. It's funny. I find that easier than just saying take a traditional Italian dish and put a French wine with it.
Mm-hmm.
And even like Chateau Neuf du Pape, going with the dish from Sardinia. The principal grape in Sardinia, that the sort of most important red grape, is Canonal, which is related to Grenache, which is the principal grape in Chateau Neuf du Pape. So,
well, and also, I mean, for me, my food is not limited. So, to a certain, even though the restaurant is has a low country name, as I have grown and learned and traveled as a chef, my food comes from not one particular place. It has many influences. So, I think it's interesting, too, that if I do Southern cooking, you're not pairing it with an American wine.
Got a follow-up from Nia. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. Okay.
I was in Rome, and there was shrimp and calamari.
Oh, good.
That sounds like a nice scenario to be in Rome.
Yum.
And have a risotto with shrimp and calamari.
Wish we were there right now.
One of the things is the shrimp, I mean, they come right out. Those things are coming out of the Tyrrhenian Sea and boom.
Yeah, that's the thing,
They're in your dish.
I grew up in the Midwest and I just did not grow up with good seafood. It just wasn't available. And the first time we went to Spain, that's when I realized just how absolutely incredible seafood can be. And I think that is an awakening experience for people.
When we come back, let's talk about French and Italian seafood treatment, because this is where I'm actually going to feed you. And we have to talk about the market. And then maybe we'll drop Chef Challenge on you. Okay. All of that and more on Informant Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. I've got a couple of listener emails here. You can reach us, foremanwolf@wypr.org, or call us, 410-662-8780. And from Barbara in Annapolis, she's asking for the details of the chimichurri from your Argentine chef.
Okay. Well, Marcelo made it a little bit differently probably than was absolutely traditional. He would chop nice ripe red tomatoes. He always said it had to be more green than red. So a lot of fresh basil, a tremendous amount of parsley, a tiny bit of fresh thyme, garlic, shallot, extra virgin olive oil, and he put raspberry vinegar in his. And I think that was because at that time, which was, again,
that was a very styly thing in the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really why he did that. And he, Marcello liked salt, and so do I. So he always put a good amount of salt in there. But that was it, and you can certainly make any version of that. Now what we do is we rarely put tomatoes in anymore, and we typically don't put acid in there. We do a good oil and heavy on the basil, parsley, again, a little bit of thyme, and we actually put pepper in, which he never did, and then a lot of shallots and a little bit of garlic. But you can always do your own version of it. It should be all about fresh herbs. And actually, if you go to Argentina, it'll be about dried herbs.
It's sometimes the year, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting thing, but I love chimichurri. It's so useful. Well, and a friend of mine that I have met in the last few years is from Colombia. He's from Bogota, and he makes something called ají. And oh my gosh, I'm in love with that now. And I use that a lot in my cooking. And what I like about that is that it doesn't have oil, and it's very fresh and bright and beautiful. And it's really all about jalapeno cilantro, finely chopped green onion, lime juice, and salt. And that's pretty well the foundation of that.
Let's take the call from Aravinda in Bel Air. Aravinda, how are you this morning?
Hi there.
Or afternoon.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Oh, I'm fine. Thanks. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You had asked about our favorite things to cook from the different cuisines.
Mm-hmm.
And, for French, I can say that I make croissants from scratch.
And that's awesome. That's work.
Well, I remembered this because you were talking about the labor of love mm-hmm. element. And it's interesting because I think just as in, I mean, I took French in high school and I saw various, Tale of Two Cities and other things. So I was really kind of, I would make croissants on Bastille Day. And in the library, they had this big book, La Russe Gastronomique. And
oh, yeah.
In the entry for a croissant, it was a single, a paragraph or so. And so my brother and sister and I joke about this because we said, oh, look at the La Russe Gastronomique recipe for croissants. It basically says make the croissants.
the old French recipes are definitely that way.
Which was a slim paperback book called Step-by-Step Guide to Making Croissants. So it's, probably 50 pages, but it's dedicated only to this one recipe. So I followed that. And so I would make them, and it was very fun.
I would just like to say, good for you. I can't even imagine making croissant from scratch at home and all that. Good for you. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Good.
And so I make everything from scratch. So especially baked goods.
That's
and
awesome.
Recently, I have. I don't even buy flour, so I mill the grain, and when you mill it and bake it the same day, it's just only way I can describe it to people is that it tastes like the bread is already buttered.
All right, that's amazing.
That's awesome.
Very, very good. Good
yeah,
for you.
And just a small response to the woman who complimented you on disagreeing civilly, I think. Mm-hmm. I think all of us who are fortunate to have enough to eat are certainly able. I mean, our disagreements are very small.
That's amen to that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
If I can just talk about the Italian as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
of course.
See, I don't even know. I am given to understand that the pizza that we're accustomed to here in the U.S. is not the same as the one in Italy. I've never been there, so I don't know. And
there are a bunch of different versions, really based upon the region, the most famous one being Neapolitan, but it's very difficult to find anything resembling Neapolitan pizza in the U.S.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, yeah, I have no idea, and I have improvised quite a bit myself. And again, I grind my wheat I grind it in the house and bake the pizza myself, and I never think of pizza as a as an unhealthy food. In fact, I mean, I first of all, I load it up with spinach, zucchini, mushrooms, all kinds of things, and it never occurs to me to say, like, you know, oh, I didn't eat, I ate pizza for lunch, so that was not healthy, because I think it's one of the healthiest foods.
Absolutely.
That I make.
Good for you.
I mean,
it can be.
I don't disagree with you that, mm-hmm. I mean, it comes from, I have the ingredients to make bread, essentially, mm-hmm. and if I'm feeling a little wealthy, I've got enough oil to actually make that dough richer, and mm-hmm. then I make the pizza dough, and then little bits and pieces of whatever else I've got around might be what is decorating that. And if you're in a very good spot, cheese that you probably made yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, in order to, like, while you probably cheese next. That you made while your dough is rising,
yeah.
is usually what's on there. You know, the mozzarella,
mm-hmm. yeah,
mozzarella. Yeah, you should try making mozzarella, as much as you apparently like to cook. I bet that would be fun for you.
Never
thought
of
that. Oh, it's
okay.
a fun process.
Make it when your dough is rising.
Yeah,
it'll be fresh.
Do it. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Sarah.
It'll be fun.
Inspired me.
Thank you for
Thank
the call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good Sunday.
Bye.
That's awesome. Email here from a listener asking for restaurants in Paris and making final arrangements for a trip this summer.
Mm. I can help with that.
Yeah, we both have favorites, but you're just back. I would say you got to watch yourself as far as when things will be closed, because places will all be closed.
When did they say they're going? In August?
They said this summer. So.
Oh, don't go in. Yeah, well, August, yeah. So anytime you want to make reservations ahead of time before you go, because then you'll need to reconfirm. If you're in Paris, you need to reconfirm the day of. So just know that, because we're not used to that here. Chez George is on 1 Rue de Maille in Paris. There is more than one Chez George. That's why I tell you the address. It's a casual bistro. It's not super inexpensive, but it's not as expensive as my other favorite bistro, which is Benoit.
Benoit's a one-star bistro.
Yeah, Alain Ducasse owns Benoit now. And Benoit's a little tricky to get to. It's actually on a walking street. So just now that we have, GPS and all this stuff, it's much easier than back in the day when you
It's funny. It's also one on the street. Because Chez Georges is at 1 Rue de Maille.
Right.
And Benoit is 1 Rue Saint-Martin.
Rue Saint-Martin. Right. So those are two great bistros. La Serre is a quite expensive restaurant. It is absolutely one of my favorites, and I've been eating there for many, many, many years. The macaroni stuffed with truffle and foie gras is probably one of my favorite dishes I've ever had in my life.
Yeah,
and
it takes pasta to make a great French dish.
And L'Ambroisie is a 3-star Michelin restaurant. I just ate lunch there a couple of weeks ago. I've eaten there several times, and I feel that chef is just absolutely brilliant. And he's constantly, really kind of blowing my mind. I mean, I've eaten there. It's always better than the last time, which is hard to imagine that it could even be. And the service is amazing. And they will speak English to you there. So if you don't speak French, it makes it a little bit of easier. So those are four. I could go on and on. Tony, what do you want to contribute? Anything? He's just looking at me.
I'm just letting you go. You love going to Paris.
Tony and I have had, and staff have had, many amazing experiences at a bistro that has been around for a long time. And it is called, what's the real name? Is it called Chez La Milouie?
Chez La Milouie.
And this place, the guy that owns it is a character.
It's the devil to get into.
It's a little bit hard to get into. You may see an actor or an actress there or someone. It is a treat, though. It is a crazy restaurant. He gets the very best product in the country, and then they pretty well just execute it in a very traditional way.
It's cooked incredibly simply. But he buys the same products that the 3 stars do.
Mm-hmm.
And the seller is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
The seller is stocked.
Yeah, don't wear high heels there, because you're going to fall down the stairs going to the ladies' room. They're kind of dangerous. especially if you've been drinking. Device.
Yeah, the voyage to the toilet is
a little frightening.
It takes being a little intrepid.
It's an old storefront. It's not the prettiest restaurant in the world. Guy Savoie is also one of my favorite chefs. He has a 3-star Michelin, and he has just moved to it's an old townhouse along the Seine. It is gorgeous. His food is incredible. Le Doyen is a restaurant that is also a three star that is on just off the Champs-Élysées. It is in it's right next to the Petit Palais, and it is oh my goodness, you could go there for lunch. Actually, I go to L'Amboisie for lunch. You know, you can kind of divide these things up and kind of maybe hit a casual bistro at night if you're kind of throwing the cash out at lunch, and you know, so, but make reservations, please, and enjoy, because it's so great.
So that's, and we took you at your word about the price was not necessarily an object. So let's talk about the market for a second.
Okay.
Because
so what's the word, Tony?
I mean, farmers I've talked to so far, a lot happier than the last several years.
Good.
It's.
Thank goodness for them, and thank goodness for us that get to eat their great product.
No weird frosts so far. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things going quickly.
Good.
Coming quickly. Excellent asparagus this year.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you can get the stuff from the Eastern Shore.
Yeah,
that's,
we've started
that's
to
always,
serve that.
Always a strong
very exciting
recommendation. I got strawberries today.
Oh, spectacular! So exciting.
From Virginia. We always roll from Virginia to the Eastern Shore also on strawberries. And blueberries will do the same thing. Blueberries are always about a month after strawberries, but I just got the first ones and... My 5-year-old, my 2-year-old, and I demolished a quart in probably 5 minutes tops.
It's exciting.
So, now what's the best Italian dish you've ever had?
We had, ironically, the name of the restaurant is the name of one of our restaurants. And I will never forget the day we walked in there, because you actually kind of surprised me going to this place. And it was incredible. But the waiters prepared... clams and linguine in the dining room.
Yeah, it's a restaurant in Palermo.
And I had never, I'd never had it where it was so unbelievably delicious. And absolutely every bit of the broth from those clams, or the liquor from those clams went into that pasta.
If you did not believe that you don't, all that you do with pasta is get it hot and get it seasoned in the water. All the actual cooking, everything that actually makes it good happens in the pan. And you watched them open the clams in the pan, you know, and work the pasta with all the ingredients.
Oh, it was incredible. Simple thing, but very, very not simple, because it was brilliant. How about you?
We don't have time for all of
those
things.
Another time. All right.
Oh my! It really, it has to be also what region, you know? That's. I mean, I have like 5 favorite regions, and that's not that I don't love the others.
Of course.
So that's all we have time for today on Formidable Phone Food and Wine. If you want to download this program or any of the others, go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page and go to town. If you want to email us with any questions, comments, or looking for other information, foremanwolf@wypr.org. To follow Chef Cindy Wolf, who's a good photographer, on social media.
Thank you, Tony. You can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf and on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf. I'm also on Facebook, but I have no idea what I'm under there. So just look for Cindy Wolf. I think that'll get you to me.
And
Tony?
You can find me, The Real Tony Foreman.
Versus where I'm any fake ones out there.
Infrequent and wry photographer. Thanks so much.
Happy Sunday.